Boag World is brought to you by headscape.co.uk in association with getsignoff.com and the website owner's manual. On this week's show, Liz Danzico introduces us to user research. We learn 10 techniques for an effective call to action and discover how one button cost a company $300 million.
Hi Paul, how are you doing?
Hi Paul, how are you?
Hello Paul.
Hi Paul.
Hi Paul and Marcus.
Hello and welcome to the first ever BoagWorld.com podcast.
Boag World!
Hello and welcome to the 100th episode of BoagWorld.com!
Hello and welcome to the 150th episode of BoagWorld.com. 150th episode!
Yeah!
Wow! Podcast for those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. 150 episodes!
That's a lot.
That is a lot. Really, we must be seriously repeating ourselves now. I think we were after about the 10th, to be honest.
Yeah, no, that's unfair. Maybe the 40th.
I've definitely started repeating myself, but do you know what? Things move so fast in this world that we call web that really what may seem like repeating is actually a new slant on something that's updated radically. That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
How long did it take you to come up with that?
I just made it up on the spot. Talking of new slants.
I don't believe you.
On things that have been around for ages.
Yeah.
HTML5. We talked about last week, didn't we?
Yes, you got a bit of a ticking off about
I did get a little bit of ticking off about that from a Mr. Jeremy Keith, who we've since discovered actually is Severus Snape in disguise. There is an uncanny resemblance. It is incredible. I will post a photograph on my Flickr account or something and put it in the show notes or some such thing to demonstrate how scary a similarity there. Unfortunately, although I mock him for being pedantic, I mock him as well for looking like Severus Snape, he was correct in his ticking off, which is that I did slightly misread the article. The date of 2022 wasn't a release date for HTML5. It was, in actual fact, the date where it's becoming mainstream, so browsers have actually already adopted it. But I did point out to Jeremy that even if you halved that date, and which would actually not make sense, if you halved that date, it would be the 11th century, wouldn't it? But 12th century. Anyway, if you know, even if you halved the length of time until that date, it's still too far to worry about. But principles are principles.
So you couldn't just say...
No, I had to have a dig as well, of course. Jeremy would expect nothing less from me.
Yeah, well now he knows what I have to live with.
Yes, as does all our listeners. So there we go, I can never be wrong. I have to be wrong in a way where I belittle other people.
Yeah, you're wrong, but you're actually right. But yes. What he was pointing out is you can't read.
Well, fundamentally, now he accused me of being lazy, which is a much of an accusation, really. It's more of a statement of the blindingly obvious, but there we go. So we got anything else to talk about, or should we just push on today?
This podcast is an official event at South by Southwest.
Oh, yeah, you wanted to talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, big deal. Who cares? So no, what we're doing, we're going to do a live show at South By. So if you are coming along to South By, there will be a live show. You can come and join us and we're going to record a show and hopefully we'll have some mediocrely famous people there, other than Marcus, and that we can then have a little jolly and it'll be lots of fun and great and wonderful. But we haven't got specific information yet.
Other than it's going to be on the Saturday at 6:30. And it'll be in the programme.
Okay, and I'll Twitter it as well.
Yes.
I want more Twitter followers, I've decided.
Oh, yeah, well, you've only got 3,000 to Brian Carson, for example, 7,000.
Well, more to the point, John Hicks, who has 5,500 or something.
Yeah, well, he's nice.
Ah, that'll be it.
Mm.
Oh, have we said that on the show? Have we let slip that we're going to be doing a joint Risington podcast soon?
No, I don't think we have.
There's lots of really cool stuff coming up, none of which we've got specific details for.
I know when it's been recorded, that one.
Do you?
February the 20th.
Yeah, but that doesn't make... I mean, Risington's release schedule, that's quite hard to say, Risington's release schedule. I still can't say it.
I'll be the editor.
Then it'll probably come out in time.
Yeah.
I have to say, you're quite good at that. And of course, what else can we talk about? Oh, yes, our wonderful Headscape Christmas do, which was really exciting.
It was good. I was really drunk, but I still... We played 12-handed Texas Hold'em, and I won.
It was pretty... It was pretty wild, as the young folks say.
Yeah, well, I'd gone to bed by then.
Yeah, so did I.
passed out, pissed, basically.
Basically, I was quite proud that I made it longer than you. I made it till 2.
Mm.
While Ed made it to 7 in the morning, went to bed for an hour, and got up drunk at 8.
Yes.
So, which was quite impressive as well. But anyway, that was fun. And you can see photographs on Flickr.
Somewhere, yeah.
If you look under Ryan Taylor, our producer was there. And yes, he's got lots of embarrassing photographs. But nobody's really interested in any of that. They're interested in web design stuff, like the kind of thing you would find in our news section of the show.
Birdworld.com.
Okay, so let's do the news. There's lots of interesting news stories this week, including, as I said in the intro, a button that cost $300 million. The fact the UK government has woken up to graded browser support, which I'm into at the moment. And we've also got some stuff about Adobe Illustrator, some nice tutorials there, and how PNG files can now be used in complete safety.
You really can't read, can you?
What?
This button did not cost them $300 million.
Or it saved them $300
million. There you go.
Well, no, because the implication was is the original button that was there did cost them Let's start with this story, shall we?
Yeah, go on.
And I'll prove the point. It's a new story that is an incredible tale from usability expert Jared Spool, who is an absolute star. And by the way, does a usability podcast. So do a search on usability podcast Jared Spool and check out that, because I'm sure it's much more informative than this. So he's got this post on his website, which really shows the power of usability testing. And in the post, he writes about a client who had a fairly standard checkout process on his website. And the process began with a login form that was, you know, basically a simple form. It had fields for email address and password, and buttons which were login and register, and then a link for forgotten password. It's the kind of form that we've all seen on e-commerce websites in the past. And this, basically, it was a feature that was designed to help repeat customers to place, you know, their repeat orders, because they can just log in and all go through very quickly. However, it created two distinct problems, this particular little form. The first was that new users resented the idea of having to register, and one actually said, "I'm not here to enter into a relationship, I just want to buy something."
How true.
Yeah, I often feel like that with e-commerce sites as well.
Most of them do let you buy.
Yes.
But not all.
Yeah, and this one didn't. And repeat users rarely remembered their usernames and passwords, and they wasted substantial time guessing, but eventually resorted to just creating a new account. In fact, on examining the database, Jared discovered that 45% of all customers had multiple registrations within the system. And some did go as far as clicking the forgotten password link, but those that did, only 25% of them then went on to place an order. So... in the end, they had to do a bit of a redesign in order to get this working. And it basically rejigged things to allow users to continue without registering. And this created, basically, all they did was change that kind of button that says, you know, log in or register as a new user to be able to continue without registering. Yeah. And that saved them $300 million in increase, or created $300 million in increased sales within a year. Of course, that figure is somewhat meaningless in itself, because it depends on how much they were earning before that to see how big an increase $300 million was. But that boils down to a 45% increase in sales just by changing that one little feature. And that's a staggering number, and kind of really drives home the importance of usability testing. So check out that story. It's a really good read from Jared there.
It's almost good enough to say that you should never register, never have to register to buy something on a website.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, it's nothing, I like, my preferred thing is you continue through and then right at the end it says, if you'd like to register, pick a username and password. We've got all your other details. You've already filled in all of that in order to be able to place
the
order.
That's cool. Yeah, but if you want to buy something on our site now, let's have all your details.
Yeah.
In that, just the way it's written.
Yeah.
Because you have to put it all down anyway.
Yes. And that was what's quite interesting in this, that they didn't ask anything in the registration process that they didn't actually need to be able to deliver it, but it was more the kind of feeling of establishing some kind of long-term relationship that most people don't care about.
No.
So a couple of weeks ago I wrote about the importance of graded browser support, and in my post I explained how we should not limit our support to browsers that we just test with, but also, you know, that we can support browsers just by the way that we build sites, and also about how it was unrealistic to push for identical support across all browsers.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is an approach that has been kind of widely adopted by people like Yahoo and also BBC, but it's also now going to be extended to public sector websites in the UK. And according to the Web Standards Project, the rules surrounding browser testing on public sector websites in the UK have been changed to better reflect best practice in the graded browser support. Changes include an emphasis on functionality over identical layout across browsers. Here you go, Marcus. This is what you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to have some kind of definitive rule somewhere, and a lot of our clients are public sector. So check this out. Paragraph 39 of the rules say you should check that the content, functionality, and display all work as intended. There may be minor differences in the way a web page is displayed. The intent is not to, not that it should be pixel perfect across browsers, but that the user of a particular browser does not notice anything appears wrong.
Yep.
Great. Really good to see that. As well, it also, this document supports progressive enhancement. And it says, you should follow a progressive enhancement approach to developing websites to ensure that content is accessible to the widest possible number of browsers. It's excellent news and certainly provides a great reference for UK designers and website owners looking to convince others of the importance of graded browser support. There's a great BBC graded browser support table that you might want to check out as well that I've actually included in the show notes to show how they kind of do things. Mm. So, good news. Okay, so from development to design now, and a list of 50 tutorials that will help you get your head around Adobe Illustrator. I try and
I've got to stop you there, Paul.
Yeah.
I just did a big yawn, and it was a quiet one. And I want to know if anyone listening now, it made them yawn.
Oh,
how spooky
subliminal
would that be?
It would be.
Right, okay, here on.
Ooh. No, that's really not that interesting. You completely broke the flow of it. You just don't care about the quality of the show anymore, do you?
No, I care about the quality of the show. I just don't care about if I annoy you.
Ah. Subtle difference. So I try and have a little bit of a mixed news story. So our first news story was kind of usability type thing. Second one was development type thing. Third one, designy. So it's basically 50 tutorials to help you get your head around Adobe Illustrator. Another one of these top 50 lists. And this one isn't from Smashing Magazine. But I've got to
they
say...
They usually only have tens, don't they? Not 50.
No, they have all kinds of random numbers. Do you remember they had 46 plus? It's like they couldn't
that's
count
right,
higher than that.
45 plus.
Yeah, like, 45 plus.
What?
A random number. But do you know what? I've done a little experiment. Actually, my listener feedback section for today is a top 10 type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know that because I did it as a top 10, it got almost 10 times the number of hits a normal one of my posts would get. Really very interesting. I don't know what it is about top 10 lists or the top 45 or whatever else. I think people just like to be able to scan down the headlines and you'll be able to see the whole article.
It's
like
you've done some research for them and ordered it out nicely so they only have to read the top bit.
No, because very rarely are they number one is the most important and number 10 is the least important in these things.
True, yeah.
But it's more that you can just scan through it really quick. It's very interesting. Anyway, so this guy's done 50 tutorials to help you get your head around Adobe Illustrator. And it's a list compiled by a UK web designer called Chris Spooner. And he echoes, to be honest, my own experience when he writes, Adobe Headscape. Where did that come from? I don't know what happened
you've
there.
You've got sort of Headscape-y, logo-y bits next to
Is that what it is, do you think? Adobe Illustrator can be a little tricky to get your head around. There we go. I was reading ahead. particularly after getting used to the workflow of applications such as Photoshop. The difference between layer uses and creating and editing shapes can be especially strange at first hand. That doesn't really actually make very good sense, does it? Oh, well. But I know what he means, which is that I'm a bit of a Photoshop man myself, and I find it very difficult to make that transition to the vector-based world of Adobe Illustrator. And this list has been particularly appealing to me because it's got some really good tutorials in it that I am going to work through if ever I have spare time. So never. It's a great list, and you'll definitely want to check it out if, like me, you've never really got to grips with Illustrator before. I was impressed. I don't normally do kind of tutorials, talk about new tutorials and news, but
this was a good one.
No. Well, I think they're a bit dull. Yeah. I've never got the attention span to work through tutorials. But these lot grabbed me for some reason. Anyway, finally today, I'd like to draw your attention, dear listener, to a new technique that has been developed by Drew Diller for using PNG transparencies in IE6. Now, I have to thank everybody that wrote in telling me about these, but I have to say, Paul, our researcher, Mr. Stanton, managed to beat you all to it. But nevertheless, I appreciate the emails telling me about it, but it just shows you how damn good Stanton is at finding new stories. So unlike previous techniques, this one allows you to use PNGs as background images instead of just as image tags. And this opens up a world of possibilities and overcomes one of the most annoying limitations of IE6. This minor miracle is achieved not by the alpha image loader, as been used by previous JavaScript libraries, but it's done with VML, of all things. Don't ask me what VML is, Marcus. What's because I VML couldn't tell you very well. It's another way of doing stuff.
It's a virtual...
It's an open source, I believe. Image. I'm really going to show my ignorance because this is a complete guess. I really should know this.
Go for it.
Shall I go for it? Shall I just guess? Yeah. I think it's the kind of open standard vector-based Dubry. It's almost a little bit like some of the vectory stuff Flash does. No, that's SV. Oh, damn, I got it entirely wrong. I've no idea what VML is. Can you edit that bit, please, Marcus?
Nope.
No. I really should know that. It rings a bell, but I can't. Jeremy will be sitting there going, he hasn't done his research. But there you go.
It's true. Would you like to go on that point a little longer?
No, I think I'll move on
the point
now.
A little longer.
So anyway, the implementation seems fairly straightforward. It involves adding a JavaScript library, just like before. Because it's only any of this only applies to IE6, because all other grown-up browsers can do this stuff anyway. You could even embed the code within a conditional comments, and no other browsers even have to download it, which is pretty good. Although I've yet to use this approach myself, I have high hopes that finally it will remove the IE6 stroke PNG barrier that we all know and love. So there we go.
Or alternatively, you could just ignore it because of graded browser support. Potentially.
Yeah, you could do. Yeah, that's a good point. You could do. But then the trouble is if you're gonna, you can't completely ignore it, because that would be more than a minor little difference. You'd have to put a GIF in or something like that, and it's actually just as quick to shove in this bit of JavaScript than recreate all of the PNGs as GIFs. So, you know, what's the point?
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Next, we have an interview with Liz Danzico, who I met at Future of Web Design, and she is a usability specialist who's going to talk to us about user research. Bugbear.com. So, joining me today for our little interview is Liz Danzico. Liz, why don't you start off by introducing yourself a little bit, telling us a bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. I am a user experience consultant. I am here in New York City. I have been building websites and user experiences online for about 12 years now. I do a lot of work with Happy Cog Studios here in New York, with Jeffrey Zeldman and Jason Santa Maria. Mm-hmm. I'm also chair of the new MFA Interaction Design Program at the School of Visual Arts in New York.
Excellent. I mean, so to say that you're an expert in user experience would be a slight understatement then, Liz.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
You'd be too modest, obviously, to say that. Okay, so we got Liz on the show. I met Liz when I went over to Future of Web Design, and we got talking, and she's got some fascinating insights into the whole area of user research, and and usability generally. And so I thought, let's get her on the show and let's maybe, you know, try and cover things from the very basic level, a kind of introduction to this concept of user research. So perhaps a good place to start, if you're okay, Liz, would be, how would you go about defining the area of user research? What would you include? What would you exclude from that?
Right. So, user research, even today, you know, we've been doing user research on the web since the very beginning. It's a very old concept, but it's still fairly controversial. The basic concept is it tells you what really happens when real people interact with your product or service. Mm-hmm. So there are no real rules about what it includes and what it doesn't. You can basically speculate about what your consumers want, or you can find out. The latter is probably a more useful approach for you to take, than speculation, although either one, thinking about your audience is useful no matter what. Mm-hmm. And so there are no real rules. Now, when you disconnect thinking about your audience from your business objectives, and you start getting, you know, very excited about behaviors that they're doing that are sort of disconnected from the real mission that you're trying to sort of accomplish, then it becomes a bit murky and confusing. Mm-hmm. But thinking about your audience is just in general is an extremely useful approach.
Okay. I mean, one of the things that I've heard said before by particularly cynical clients, I have to say, but I've heard it said before, you know, ultimately user research and all of this kind of stuff feels in some ways like just another way for web designers to suck a bit of extra money out of us. You know, that it fundamentally has, you know, I know my audience already is the kind of attitude that many website owners have. So why do you see it as an important part of the process?
Well, as we've been seeing, you know, design flaws often translate to lost business opportunities. You know, usability is becoming more important than ever as, you know, the number of websites and products is, you know, increasing, more and more every day. So we design these products and services, and we are at the same time users of them, but there's no way that we can really tell what our users might want. And the best way to, you know, usability research doesn't a lot of money. So the best way that you can help your clients kind of understand that you need to do usability research in some way is to let them know that, you know, usability research is important and it doesn't need to suck up a lot of time or money in the process. So there's a great, fantastic book by Steve Krug called Don't Make Me Think, mm-hmm. which you're probably well aware of. And in one of the chapters towards the end, he has a chapter called Usability Research on a Shoestring or something like that is probably better titled, which talks about, you know, this approach of going out into the hallway and kind of grabbing people and just sitting them down and kind of putting them in front of your product or service and getting some feedback. So getting some feedback from people, no matter who they are, is better than getting none at all. And so I think starting there with a client, instead of showing them the, you know, $100,000 user research project that's going to take you across 8 markets, you know, in the United States, the UK, and Asia, you know, then is going to be a much better approach than kind of intimidating them with the, you know, the very extensive project.
I mean, when the kind of one scenario that I've come across before is where we've come across with clients that say, oh, well, we've already done user research. We already know about our audience because we've got somebody in to do this and that. Is there a difference between user research that has been done primarily with an offline audience and those, you know, when you're interacting with people online? Is there a difference in the kind of results and information that you're after and even the techniques maybe that you use?
So they are probably, when they say that they've done user research, they're probably talking about focus groups. Mm-hmm. I would venture to guess that when they talk about that, they're probably talking about either focus groups or surveys of some kind.
Yeah.
And those are not, well, I wouldn't say that they are those are bad things to do, but those are not the kind of user research techniques that are going to give them feedback about their product's usability.
Okay.
So those kinds of techniques are going to give them good information about certain kinds of things, but they're not going to give them information about whether or not people can use the product or service that they're trying to that they're looking at. So so you want to find out exactly what kinds of user research they have conducted. If they say the words focus group, then you know you want to move them towards something that is a one-on-one kind of interview.
Okay.
Focus groups tend to be conducted with groups of people, as the name might suggest. And when groups of people get together to talk about, you know, they put forth a question for these people. And when they, you know, groups of people get together to talk about the question, they might influence one another in their answers. They're typically not talking about an interface. They're typically talking about ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not getting good feedback in a one-on-one kind of scenario. So you want to sort of guide them to a more individual one-on-one kind of experience. Surveys, on the other hand, are good, but they don't get that kind of personal experience with a moderator sitting with an individual kind of looking at an interface in a kind of task-based scenario.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, let's then talk about some of the techniques that can be used to better understand your users, or particularly how those users will interact with your, you know, your product. What different kind of techniques do you use? I mean, there's the kind of very basic usability session, but do you do, you know, are there other things above and beyond that that you do?
Right. Well, the sort of big secret is that there are names and there are certainly techniques, but the big secret is there are really no sort of techniques beyond knowing who your users are, kind of documenting what you're seeing,
mm-hmm.
and then kind of analyzing, prioritizing the results of what you see. I'm going to tell you a number of techniques that we can go through.
Sure.
But if those basic sort of constructs are there, then you've done sort of good user research. Now, that being said, the techniques that you can do are usability testing.
Mm-hmm.
Usability testing traditionally has taken place in a usability lab.
Mm-hmm.
Where a moderator is sitting with an individual looking at a screen or a product or a sketch of an interface and going through questions in sort of a task-based way, asking people, you know, show me how you would search for X, or show me how you would check out, or, you know, and measuring the kind of success or failure of that kind of task.
Mm-hmm.
The clients are typically sitting behind a one-way glass, a one-way mirror, and observing these kinds of things. People have been not so thrilled about this technique recently, saying that it kind of doesn't produce kind of natural reactions from
sure.
from users. But that is one kind of technique. There is, you know, kind of creating personas and using personas, user personas, which are an archetype of your site or product's users.
Mm-hmm.
And getting everyone involved in activities around those personas, whether that be, you know, using personas as you're talking through features around, you know, a brainstorming session,
mm-hmm.
And getting people to sort of role play those kind of personas. That is another sort of user research kind of method.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of the ethnography kind of take, where a lot of people have been doing kind of in-home interviews and observations recently.
Sure.
ethnography, cultural anthropologists, and people who have been doing traditional ethnography have been watching closely the design research that we've been doing recently and wondering if we've been doing it right and so on. But ethnography in that sort of observing users in their natural environment has been, I would say, a more successful way recently of watching people use products and services. Mm-hmm. So I would say that, you know, those three things, usability testing in a lab, sort of using personas and user scenarios, and ethnography, kind of going out into the field and watching users, whether they're in their homes or their offices, are the three kind of key ways to gather user research outwardly with users. The fourth way that I'll mention, and we can talk about this in a little bit, is not with users directly, but it is certainly user research that's available more and more now, and that is data on sort of site analytics, something that you can, you know, gather mm-hmm. from Google Analytics, Sean Inman's Mint, these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Watching site data and user behavior through site analytics is another form of user research that gives you some information, and you can watch, you know, traffic patterns on your site. It doesn't answer the question why, but it does show you some evidence as to how users are behaving on your site.
Mm-hmm. It's quite interesting that you bring up ethnography. Ugh, I can't even speak today. Because that's of interest to me because it's an area that we're beginning to explore a little bit more and have kind of discovered the same thing that, you know, there's a real value of going into, you know, somebody's home, seeing the environment that they access the internet on. You know, do they have kids under their feet? Mm. You know, where is their PC? Can they sit comfortably at it? All those kinds of things. Right. But I guess there's also an advantage. You don't have to hire an expensive usability lab and all of the rest of it. But I have to confess, I'm a little bit new at it. So talk me through maybe some of the things. You know, how does it differ from a usability test that you would do in a usability lab other than the fact that you're in a different environment?
Well, it depends. It doesn't have to differ at all. Okay. It depends on the goals of the test. I would say that you can construct a test that's exactly like one that you'd conduct in a lab. It just happens in someone's home or mm-hmm. office or in a different environment. But as you said, you get the more realistic sort of interruptions, you know, and that mm-hmm. kind of thing of, you know, are they going to be able to complete this task given the natural kind of occurrences of their day? Mm-hmm. And that, depending on what kind of tests you are constructing, that's either going to inform your results or not. Mm. If you are doing task-based testing, so I could maybe talk about the different kinds of usability testing that you could do. So there are different ways that you can conduct a usability test. Traditionally, there is task-based testing where you set up pre-written questions before you get to the test that are based on the goals of the testing. So if we were testing a photo site, you know, we would test whether or not users could upload photos, could they tag photos, you know, these kinds of things. We would write those questions beforehand and then ask those questions during the test. That's one kind of test. And you could do that in a lab, and you can do that same test in someone's home. In a lab, there would not be the children screaming and the phone ringing, you know, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And therefore, if someone, say, were uploading a photo, you would never be able to tell whether sort of like timing out would be an issue or anything that has to do with sort of time and space and, you know, motion. If those kinds of things are a goal of your test, then, you know, you might want to think about doing it in real time in mm-hmm. someone's home environment. Another type of testing is something that I'll say it was first coined by Mark Hurst, who's a user experience consultant at Good Experience. And I think he coined it. It's called listening labs.
Okay.
Listening labs are sort of I'll call them experimental, but, you know, I they've probably been going on long before I was aware of them, where people are designing usability tests in real time. So in other words, you go into the test with absolutely nothing written down, and you sit down with users, and based on your initial interview with them, you hear who they are, and after understanding a little bit about how they use photos in general, say, then you kind of write the questions on the fly and then sort of develop a test around who that person is and their behavior with your product or product type.
Which I guess makes people more engaged with the test because it's about what they specifically are interested in. Is that the idea?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So it's a more natural way of doing the test. That's the idea. That kind of thing you can do either way and probably is even more rewarding if you're doing it in someone's natural environment. And then the third type of test is sort of a web-wide kind of test where you have people just sort of surf the internet, as it were, and just have them think out loud. And that kind of thing is also, I've found, more rewarding and fruitful in someone's home environment because they have their bookmarks there and they have their post-it notes and kinds of things around them, whereas you put them in a kind of artificial setting and they don't have those things around them. So if you know, it kind of just depends on the type of testing that you're doing. If you're doing just the first kind I talked about, just task analysis and having people go through that kind of task-based testing, doing it in a traditional usability lab is great. You know, I mean, you really do get the answers that you're looking for. But it just depends on your goals.
I mean, it's interesting going back to Steve Krug's book that you mentioned. I mean, he talks about, I guess his agenda in that book is to get people testing who perhaps aren't previously. And so he, you know, he really downplays things like the demographic of who it is that you test and that it's more important that you test and to get the right people, you know, and all of that kind of thing. But when you're going into somebody's home and interacting them, guessing it's more important to get the right demographic. Is that, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, one of the, well, I think it's always important to get the right demographic. But I would say that there is a hierarchy of common mistakes around usability testing that's kind of has this like trickle down effect. You know, the number one mistake is not conducting any research at all. And conducting research on the wrong audience is kind of further down the list. So if, you know, if you're doing research on the wrong audience, it's not going to affect whether you do it in a lab or you're doing it at your desk in the, or at the water cooler or, you know, in their home. It's going to affect your results in your analysis, you know, no matter where it takes place. I think that the drawback is you are going to waste more time going out to that person's home. So it's going to be a drawback for you. But I don't think that it's it doesn't matter where it happens. If you're testing on the wrong audience, you're testing on the wrong audience. You're probably going to get more information out of that experience if you're in someone's home than if you're not. So if you're going to test on the wrong audience, do it in someone's home. Because it's a richer experience. You're going to get more information out of it than you would if you're just testing in a lab.
No, that makes perfect sense. I kind of see that. I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because obviously finding the right demographic of people and you know, picking the right people to test on is tricky. You know, it's a more difficult thing and it can be time consuming. So have you got any advice about that? I mean, what really matters here? You know, for example, if you're designing a website for an over 60s audience, do you want to concentrate on the age aspect of that or the technical literacy aspect of that? You know, is it okay to have somebody younger if they're not as good with the internet, if your audience isn't it? I'm kind of not wording this very well, but you get the idea. You know, what's important when you're trying to match demographics?
It's Very specific to your clients. Okay. Developing a, so you, whenever you are trying to match demographics, you want to work with your clients to develop what's called a screener. And a screener is, I would say, whether you're trying to develop a pretty rigorous recruiting demographic with a professional recruiter to, say, recruit, you know, 300 people for an extensive study, or whether you're going to, you know, go out into the hallway and grab some people or recruit from something called Craigslist, which a lot of people are familiar with, which a lot of people do. I would say developing a screener, which kind of outlines your demographic, is a really good idea.
So what kind of things would that include? Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, and what a screener is it kind of goes through, it's a questionnaire that kind of outlines a number of questions that you would ask a potential recruit that says, if this person can answer a particular question, we should keep them in or out. And it's actually a really good exercise to go through that allows you to kind of think through the type of demographic that you would have. Mm. So that doesn't answer your question in any way. That's just a tool. That's just a tool to get there.
It's very interesting, mine. Can you give me an example? Sorry, I'm interested in this screener thing because I haven't come across it before. Can you give me an example of the type of questions? I mean, obviously they're going to be specific to the individual client and all the rest of it, but what kind of questions?
What kind of questions? So, you know, would, let's see, would this person, so let's see, has this, I mean, typical questions could be around financial demographics, mm-hmm. age demographics, okay. I mean, the sort of typical things. But let me think of something more interesting. So does this person, you know, is this person a full-time student? Has this person been fired from a job in the last 6 months? Has this person participated in usability research in the last 6 months? Those kinds of things.
Right.
Yeah, if the person answers yes or no, then they're not a good candidate. But there are other kinds of things that you can put into that screener that might be more specific to the project that
so
you
could,
are.
Could it even include something like, you know, is this person aware of a certain brand? Because
absolutely.
You want to associate with that brand.
Right. So does this person drink Coca-Cola on a regular basis, yes or no?
Right, yeah.
Kind of thing. But I found that the screener, because the clients that you work with is often kind of speaking in those terms about their audience, mm-hmm. The screener is a really good way to kind of help them understand how you're recruiting audiences and kind of a good tool to kind of work together with them to narrow down who you want to be in the target audience for your testing or your research in general. Mm. So that said, how do you develop a good kind of set of participants for a research study for say a you know product for people over 60? What's most important? You know, it depends on. And I know I hate to say that it depends, but you're going to develop a goal for the testing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the goal might be about, you know, visibility. The goal might be about navigation. It might be about design. It might be about it's going to have. You have to first identify the goal, and depending on what that goal is, then you can identify the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So, the audience. You know, the goal might have nothing to do with age, although the product has everything to do with age, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can kind of strip away, you can kind of pull apart the product from the goal of the testing a bit and sort of just focus on the goal of the test. And that's why developing goals for user research is so critical, because oftentimes you can separate those and therefore develop a better kind of set of participants for that mm-hmm. user research.
Mm. That's really good. I think what we've done here is, you know, a lot of people that listen to this show probably have, you know, a basic understanding of user testing. You know, maybe they've done some basic user testing before. Maybe they've even written persona before. But I think what we've done is push people a little bit further to kind of consider in a little bit more detail what they're doing in order to kind of refine the results that they're getting back. And that's really, really great. I mean, if somebody has just kind of done the very basics, if they've done, you know, they've grabbed some people, they've done some user testing, maybe in their own office in front of their own PC, and they've got a few people in, maybe they've created a couple of personas. What's the next step for them? Where should they be pushing? Is it to do this screener? Is that the number one thing they should be doing? Is the goals more important? Is getting a better demographic important? What's the kind of next step for them?
That's a good question. Well, I think that one of the doing the research is really key. Mm-hmm. Analyzing the research and connecting the research to the next iteration of a design is also key. We haven't talked about that at all.
No, we haven't. That's a good subject, actually. Yeah, we
ought to. It's often a gray area. You know, there are lots of reports that are produced. There are lots of, you know, diagrams and things. But there's a lot of kind of intuition that happens between sort of translating the research and putting that feeding the research back into the design. There are hunches, leaps of faith, you know, kind of in between the analysis and the design. I mean, there are clear-cut recommendations that that one can make, but then there are a lot of more gray areas. Mm. So I would say that I still think, even though I mentioned we've been doing this kind of research for, you know, at least, you know, more than a decade online and for quite a long time offline, I think we still need to get better at the rigor at which we translate those recommendations and findings. So that's one place I think we need to focus. Mm-hmm. In terms of the actual research itself, you know, there's something, I think there are other sorts of techniques. I'm interested in these kinds of emergent research techniques, like the listening labs. Mm-hmm. You know, where the kinds of things that we're looking at today with kind of mobile research, you know, with where people are, you know, we need to be looking at how people are using our sites, not just in the browser on their desktop, but in that browser, you know, on their phone, mm-hmm. and how their context is changing constantly and how we need to sort of like look at that adaptation. Mm-hmm. So how do we develop tests that are more emergent and can be a bit more flexible? Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think there's something interesting about that listening lab approach where, you know, we kind of understand a person and then develop a set of questions around a person and their, you know, how they use a product rather than having a pre-written set of questions, you know. So something that's more emergent, I think that's an area that will be interesting to kind of look at. You know, ethnography, kind of, you know, really understanding, I think goes right along with this emergent user research. As you said, you've been getting more excited about ethnography as well. So thinking more about kind of fine-tuning our approach to, you know, people's own context, whether that be ethnography, going into their homes, their offices, you know, where people are using our products, you know, whether that be on the street, in the hallway, wherever it is, but really understanding how to find people where they're using our products and test them or do some research around that. I think that's really exciting and a really interesting opportunity. So that's the next step for us. And I think that the way that people are designing tests and doing some usability testing now is, you know, is good. I think that, I don't think that, you know, there's a big kind of next step that we can all take together. But I think these are three areas that I think as a discipline that we're going to see people kind of moving forward together in.
Excellent. Let's finish off then with just a kind of where people should go. If you know, if they've been excited by this interview, if they want to kind of learn a little bit more about user research and user testing, you've mentioned Steve Krug's book. What mm-hmm. kind of other resources are out there that people should be looking towards?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. I was thinking about that, and there are physical places that people can go, but they're all in San Francisco in the United States. So that's not going to help anyone. There is, you know, Alist Apart has a user science topic that often publishes, you know, user research related methods like top articles. There's always boxesandarrows.com, which has user research related topics. Adaptive Path, which is a user research consultancy, or at least one aspect of what they do, they publish a number of articles, but they also do events. And a lot of the events are in the United States right now, but they may have international events as well. But they do kind of give away a lot of their content.
Cool.
And then last but not least, there's a new-ish publisher called Rosenfeld Media. And the books that Rosenfeld Media publishes are about methods around user experience. And one recently, web form design, was about the usability of web form design by Luke Rabluski.
Yeah, I saw that. That looked very good, I have to say.
Yeah, so that's something to keep an eye on as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Liz. That was absolutely superb. And I will be fascinated to get you back on the show in the future to talk more depth about some of these issues. Thank you very much for your time, Liz.
My pleasure.
Bugwrite.com.
Okay, well, I promised you earlier in the show a top 10 list, and a top 10 list you shall have.
Here it is.
Dear listener.
How exciting.
It was sparked off by an email sent to me by Jeff. Thanks, Jeff, from Brighton. He wrote to me asking, you were totally unprepared for that, weren't you?
I was fiddling.
Yeah, well, stop fiddling and read what you're supposed to.
Fiddling with my computer, I might add.
Yes. Probably best to add that.
Okay, I'm going to be Jeff now. Does Jeff actually exist?
Yes. What's that supposed to mean? Does he sound like a particularly phony name?
No, I've got Bill. Bill, if Bill, is Bill ever appears, he doesn't. He's a figment of my imagination.
Yes.
Okay. Occasionally, I hear you talk about the importance of having a call to action on the show, but you never go into much depth. Nothing changes there.
Yeah. Now, that's how you know it's real, because it's insulting us.
I recognise the importance of having a call to action, but how do I encourage users to complete them?
Ah, good question, Jeff. And an excuse for me to do a top 10 techniques for an effective call to action. Having an effective call to action is an essential part of any website. A call to action is not just limited to e-commerce sites. Every site has objectives that they want users to complete, whether it's to fill in a contact form, a sign up for a newsletter or volunteer time or whatever else, to be honest. A call to action provides a focus for your site, a way to measure your site's success, and really a kind of direction for your users. Users like to know, you know, what they should be doing and where they should be going. How then do you go about creating an effective call for action? Well, I just happen to have 10 handy tips that will help you achieve just that. Number one is to lay the groundwork. Before a user is willing to complete a call to action, they need to recognize a need. Infomercials always do this very well. Before they ask people to respond, they first identify the problem and then present a product that solves that problem. So you've got a big, fat, flabby stomach, and we've got a miracle device that you just strap around your waist, and miraculously, with you doing no effort whatsoever, you end up with perfect abs, that kind of thing.
But what's wrong with a big, fat, flabby stomach?
Nothing at all, but they persuade you that there is a need there.
Thing. You are a lesser human being.
Exactly, and that's why infomercials work. And for better or worse, they do work, which is, you know, we all laugh at them and take the mickey out of them, but they do work and they do make a lot of money. And I must admit, I have even been known to fall for this before, especially in America. All of the infomercials in America, I just believe. I don't know whether it's the American accent or something, but they just completely swallow me entirely.
I tend to have the exact opposite effect on me.
Oh, do you?
Well, actually, no, I just don't believe any of them.
No.
Okay.
But that's, you're a cynic, aren't you?
Yes.
We also need to communicate the benefits of responding. What will the user get out of completing a call to action? Take, for example, the VoIP service, Skype. Immediately before, above their call for action, which is on their homepage and is a big download button, they have the following text. Make calls from your computer, free to other people on Skype, and cheap to phones and mobiles around the world. So they perfectly and clearly sum up what benefits you'll get for completing their call to action, which is to download Skype.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with their homepage, can you?
No. Very, very well thought through, very good. Although I'm not entirely sure about the completely unrelated imagery that goes with it. But anyway, that's another story for another time, maybe.
Okay,
number two is offer a little extra. Sometimes you have to sweeten the deal to encourage users to complete a call to action. Incentives could include discounts, entries into competitions, or even a free gift. And this is the approach of Barack Obama.
Barack Obama. Oh dear. It was a late night on Friday and haven't quite recovered yet.
Not entirely.
That's fantastic.
Because I never normally stumble over my words. I am a completely professional radio presenter.
Barack Obama. That's
yes,
brilliant.
Obama, even. It's the approach that he used on his fundraising site. So if you made a donation of $30 or more, you got a free T-shirt. Of course, the beauty of this is not only did he persuade you to donate a large amount of money, he also turned you into a billboard, you know, which is great advertising for him. So good move. But he sweetened the deal in order to encourage people to complete his call to action, which was to donate.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, have a small number of distinct actions. It's also important to be focused in your calls to actions. Too many, and the user becomes overwhelmed. And studies in supermarkets have shown that shoppers, if they're presented with too many varieties of something, are actually less likely to make a purchase. By limiting the number of choices a user has to make, we reduce the amount of mental effort, and effectively you're guiding the site around the site step by step.
The user around the site.
What did I say?
The site around the site.
Around the site, around the site.
You really aren't with it
today. I'm not. Leave me alone. So the number of appropriate actions will vary from site to site. There we go. I keep reading too far ahead. That's my trouble. However, it is not so much the number of actions that matter as the distinctiveness of each one. Take, for example, a site called pbwiki.com. They have three calls to action.
Is that Paul Moag Wiki?
No.
Okay.
Except I suspect they probably named it after me. Being that much of a superstar I am.
Mm.
I have all kinds of influences, Marcus. You cannot begin to comprehend.
The logo is a sandwich. Cool.
Anyway, they've got three calls to action. They've got create a wiki, view the demo, and buy now. Now, it's not that having three calls to action is an unacceptable number. It's just that there is a really clear distinction between create a wiki and buy now. So what do you do first? Do you create the wiki or do you buy the wiki before you create it? You see what I mean?
Yep.
There's a bit of confusion there. And I was left confused, which perhaps is a reflection on me rather than on the website.
No, that's a fair point that okay. I was about to make, because I was about to say, Paul, why are you picking a stupid one?
But right.
There we go. There's a reason for it.
A better approach would be to push the buy option later in the process once the user has committed to all the effort of building a wiki. Then you print out, you know, you say, well, actually, you need to pay some money for this.
Mm-hmm.
Number four, then, is use active urgent language. A call to action should clearly tell the user what you want them to do. They should have active words like call, buy, register, subscribe, donate, that kind of thing. All of these encourage users to take action. And to create a sense of urgency and a need for people to act now, these words can be used alongside phrases such as offer expires 31st of March or for a short time only, or order now and receive a free gift. And Carsonified use this approach when they're selling workshops. To create a sense of urgency, they offer discounts to those who sign up as early birds. So, interesting kind of approach. And again, it seems a little bit tacky and markety and advertising-y, but it works, and so you can't ignore it, really. Number five is to get the position right. Another important factor is the position of your call to action on the page. Ideally, it should be placed high on the page and in the central column. PixEngines.com does this very well by placing their See in Action call to action centrally on the page above the fold. Number six is white space. I'm moving through them a bit faster now as we're beginning to build momentum. It's not just the position of your call.
A stupid accent.
Yes, I know.
The world.
It's not just the position of your call to action that matters. It's also the space around it. The more space around your call to action, the more attention you draw to it. And if you clutter up the page, or the space around the call to action, it ends up getting lost in the overall noise. And there's something. There's a website called PlanHQ that does an excellent job of focusing users on their call to action by surrounding them with lots of empty white space. I ought to say at this point that there are screenshots of all of this in the blog post that goes with this, and you can get to all of that and indeed all the other links we've mentioned at boagworld.com/podcast/150. Number 7 is to use alternative colours. Colours is an effective way of drawing attention to elements, especially if the rest of the page is a fairly limited palette. Things, which is a Getting Things Done application for the Mac, does this expertly on their website. While the rest of the page is predominantly muted blues and greys, their call to actions are highlighted in an orange, and this extreme contrast leaves you no doubt about what they want you to do next.
Orange and blue is a common one.
And it works well.
It does.
Which is good. Number 8 is to make it big. It's funny, isn't it, that as web designers, we often
make
get...
Make it bright and big.
Yeah, exactly. We often get annoyed, don't we, at clients who say, make my logo bigger, make my thing bigger, whatever. It's certainly true that size isn't everything, Marcus. We've already established that position, colour and white space are equally important. We are still talking about websites here. However, it cannot be denied that the size does play a part. The bigger your call to action, the more chance it will get noticed. Mozilla have taken this to the extreme on their Firefox homepage, where their download link kind of dominates the page, really. And I swear it used to be even bigger than it is now, but it's certainly pretty substantial. Number 9.
But that's I don't think it is. I think it's right.
Well, that's because you're only seeing part of the page in that screenshot.
Well, even that would make it take smaller space.
But it's still fairly big.
What else
big.
Do you want to do there?
I don't know. I'm agreeing with it. Okay. It's my point. I said, make it bigger. But it is pretty big.
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay, number 9.
Move on. Nearly there.
Have a call to action on every page. We're kind of getting to obvious territory here. A call to action should not just be limited to the homepage. Every page on your site should have some form of call to action to lead the user on. If a user reaches a dead end, they're likely to leave your site. Your call to action does not need to be the same on every page. Instead, you can have smaller actions that lead the user towards your ultimate goal. 37 Signals understand the importance of having a call to action on every page. At the foot of every page on their Basecamp website, they have clearly displayed links to their tour and sign-up page. And finally, number 10, carry the call to action through. Consider what happens when the user does respond to a call to action. The rest of the process needs to be carefully thought through as the call to action itself. And one particular word of warning, if you require users to provide personal data, how many times have we said this? But resist the temptation to collect unnecessary information. Marketing people like to build up their demographic information. And although I can appreciate the value of this, it can bring a danger of users dropping out of the process. WordPress.
Well, it links beautifully back to the $300 million button.
Yeah, totally. WordPress.com is an excellent example of how to minimise the amount of data collected and to get someone through that call of action as quickly as possible. They have only minimal information required to set up a blog, and it's a good example you might want to check out. Okay, so that's about it, really. That an effective call to action is effectively a linchpin to a successful website and involves drawing together best practice in usability, creative visual design and powerful copywriting. And there we go. I think we'll probably wrap up there.
It's still relevant.
Okay.
If I'm asking people, occasionally you get requests for tenders coming through from people and you read it and you think, why have they got a website?
Yeah, because that's what it's lacking, a call to action.
And that's the first thing I'll ask them. Is what do you want people to do on your homepage, for example?
Yeah.
What has to happen? What do you? And quite often they're like, I don't know. So it's important stuff.
Very interestingly, the 10-point thing doesn't work as well on a podcast. That seemed too long, didn't it?
Yeah.
There's too much there.
You should have
interesting.
I don't know.
So we'll see what other people say. I think calls to action's a really interesting area, and I think it's an area that can do a lot of improvement on.
Indeed.
Believe it or not, that wraps up today's show. We seem to power through that. I guess it's because we didn't have to do anything about the interview.
No.
So have
I've got some more news.
Oh, you got more news?
Yeah, I applied for a job as a bin man the other day.
Yeah.
I was a little worried that I wouldn't fully understand, but apparently you pick it up as you go along.
Ah. So you got a joke then? Thank you very much for that,
Ian.
Marcus. That was lovely. And Ian.
Mm-hmm.
It was a real pleasure to have that at the end of today's show. Hope you enjoyed it. This was our 150th episode. I feel like we should have done something special.
Well, we got drunk on Friday.
That counted, didn't it?
Yes.
I think so. So we celebrated. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, and we'll see you again next time.
Hello, world of Boehm. Like being on David Letterman.
Poetic world, poetic world.